Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
On today's show, we have actor and comedian Maz Jobrani here to talk about his sister's film, Everything Must Change. It's a movie about her journey and experience with breast cancer treatment.
It's uplifting, sad, and funny all at the same time.
Stick around.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. Thank you guys so much for coming. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
How we doing, guys?
Very good. Very good, Joe. Joe, how are you doing?
I'm great.
I'm very good because last week, I talked about it on the last episode, but I took and finished the boards.
Nice.
And I'll let you guys know only if I pass.
That's right.
I will not reveal if I fail, which I won't find out for several months. But I will definitely let you know if I pass.
If the observant listener never hears us mention the boards again, that means she didn't pass.
No. If we never mention it again, it means nothing. Because I'm practicing only as a gastroenterologist, and this is not for GI. This is for medicine. This is for primary care doctors and doctors taking care of patients in the hospital. I'm a GI doctor. I'm not necessarily responsible as a sole provider for anyone who only has a classic medical problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, except what happens then? No, I guess the question. Why do you have to take it then?
She's just showing off because she wants
right.
to.
I'm what we call a gunner.
Yeah, okay.
Boarded.
I misunderstood. I thought it was a lot more pressure.
Let's talk about that term. That's a term called being a gunner. I don't know if I ever explained that term to you, but
what
something
does that
we
mean?
Use in medical school in particular, and I think it still applies because even when people leave medical school, they still kind of take that medical school mentality with them. So a gunner is like someone who's really hardcore. He's gunning for you. He or she is gunning for that top grade no matter what it takes. What's worse than a gunner is a closet gunner.
Those are the worst,
which are super the kind of guy who's like, oh, dude, I don't even study. I'm just going to chill this weekend.
I got so drunk last night.
Oh, totally got wasted and watched House or whatever. And then reality, they're studying
Jerry Springer
all night. They're working the hardest of anyone, but they're keeping it under wraps.
Right.
So you then feel like, oh, well, I'm relaxed. I'm not going to, no one else is working. I'm trying to relax.
Right. I mean, in the end, we all got to med school because we had that drive. And the most sort of people that I appreciated were the ones who were in the library who were like, I'm going to the library to study my ass off. Just own it. If you're going to be a dork, if you're going to be a gunner, if you're going to be a lazy bum, whatever, just own it, you know? So those kids were gunners. So Kaveh's teasing me that the only reason I took this test that is not necessary, I took a test that is not necessary because I'm a gunner. Mind you, I had the day off from work, so there's that.
So why not ruin it by taking an all-day test?
Very importantly, I think there was a question, maybe on herpes. Just to put it out there.
Maybe.
No judgment, no comment.
We are looking at Joe.
And I have a question about that.
Go ahead.
I'm going to quiz you right now.
About herpes?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Just you asking a question about herpes isn't going to help dispel the myth that we created from the show.
It's not going to cure your herpes. No, I'm teasing.
I do not have herpes for the record.
Joe does not have herpes that we know of.
But we have to say that we don't know of. And that's what my question is. When you go in, theoretically, to get all your tests for all your STDs.
When the patient
do you notice that the HSV 1 and 2 is missing from the blood test, the list of blood tests? Oh, damn it. I'm going to get crap for that one. The phone.
Your phone? Yeah.
Yeah.
Am I correct that most other time herpes is diagnosed is through a visual symptom of it, an a lesion.
You're asking, is it a routine thing to go in and just get routine herpes?
I guess what I'm saying is there really an effective way to really test for it? And if so, like a blood test for it? And if so, how come it's not really used that often? It seems like most diagnosis is of herpes happen to be visual when the symptoms actually come out during a breakout. Is that correct or no?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's not something that is screened for, if that's what you're
what
saying.
I mean.
So asymptomatic
why can't
herpes,
you screen for it?
For the most part, you don't need to know about it, right? Because it's not causing damage. But when it comes a sore, again, you're going to know. And then there's no cure. There is medication that can suppress it and can reduce the duration of a sore. So acyclovir is the one that's most commonly used, and you take it, or there's cream and stuff, and you take it, and instead of maybe 7 days of a open sore, you have like 3 or 4 days, you know, and you're still not going to want to kiss anyone or perform oral sex or have sex or anything with anyone with an open, open sore. But again, if it's not a sore on your face or your genitals, then you don't actually need to know.
Well,
it's not causing
damage.
And kind of getting to what I think is your point, doing my little Joe, like trying to read his
brain.
Mind.
Trying to understand why it's not
like,
tested for.
Because just because like you have the antibody, if you check for the antibody, just because you have it does not mean that you have an infection, like an active infection. So most people who have the antibody have never had a herpes outbreak. Here's another topic that is probably way beyond the means and the depths of this show, but I think it's probably an appropriate time to bring it up with everything that's happening in the news. And it's already sort of, it's been going on for a couple of weeks now. It's been going on for years and years and years and years, but now it's sort of becoming pretty commonplace to discuss on the news is sexual harassment. And I was thinking about this. I was thinking people were putting up these Me Too hashtags, mm-hmm. and it was incredibly common. It was incredibly common. So many people that I didn't ever suspect had an issue with that. And people from all kinds of different jobs. And I was wondering if we have the same issue in medicine. And I know we must, because it seems to be in every other goddamn field. But I always felt like medicine was a little different. I don't know why. I mean, maybe it's because I felt that women...
Really?
Because it's true.
Nurses. Nurse
it's
and
because
doctor.
Of the concept of doctor hot.
Doctor,
you're just not
doctor,
hot enough.
Doctor, nurses.
I mean,
nurses.
Separate from the... We'll get back to the nurse issue in a second. But I mean, in terms of in like medical school, within doctors.
Yeah.
Is it there? I'm sure it must be. I know it. But I always felt like one, it was different because we're supposedly... this, you know, sort of higher calling of people with like ethics and whatnot. And then the second thing is, you know, women in modern medicine seem to, in my mind, and I'm sure you can correct me if I'm wrong, don't necessarily have like any sort of subservient role to men. I don't feel like, you know, but is it there? I mean, I don't expect you. I don't want you to tell us any story. I don't want personal stories. So
it's interesting. We talked about liability. Like, I wonder what Hollywood production companies have with respect to liability. Like, how crazy. Like, they must have so many problems. Anyway, that's a side note. And the Me Too thing, I have like this philosophical issue, and I think you and I talked about it a few weeks ago. Is I think a lot of people just put Me Too hashtags, and we're really kind of riding that train just to show support. You know, not necessarily saying I was harassed or I had been harassed, because I kept thinking, I'm like, oh, should I do it to show support? But I never feel like it's, yes, there's been catcalls, people are not necessarily appropriate, but I've never felt harassed in a way that it's affected my life or my career or my day to day. So I'm like, me putting it, is that like crying wolf? Like, is that weird say Me Too if I never felt?
I don't think that's what it would mean. I think
it's totally like sisterhood, go girls,
and not just
go
that,
women.
Not just that, but even people who, I mean, obviously there's a difference between someone who got raped and someone who got catcalled, but both are, I think some people would argue, symptoms of an underlying problem, of an underlying issue with misogyny in the country. So I think...
Misogyny. I was like, oh, misogyning? Harvey Weinstein?
There's no problem with misogyning in the country.
Okay, under harassment. Under duress, I mean. So me personally, there's never been, like I said, anything that's impacted what I felt was my career path. And I do think, you know, my mother was a doctor in the 1970s, like going through training. And I think those women were in this sort of corner of what a woman should be, but were probably the baddest asses, right? Because how do you become the only woman or one of 5% of the population?
Can I give you an analogy to this?
Yeah.
So when the FBI is training its agents and it presents them this like scenario, it says, you enter a room of three terrorists. There's one big buff dude terrorist. There's one small, skinny little guy terrorist. And there's an average woman terrorist. And they all have guns. And you have to make a decision as to who you're going to try and take down first. And they say, who do you take down first? And the answer is to take down the woman, because if she's made it in that field,
she's the baddest, she's the of most, asses.
She's the killer. Yeah. She's the one you have to be the most worried
exactly.
about.
No, exactly. Right. So I think that those women probably suffer the most harassment and, you know, misogyny, but probably were just the strongest, you know? So I told Kaveh this when the whole Harvey Weinstein thing and Me Too, let's say, movement came out. And there's definitely been interactions with people who are superiors where I just felt like I got this big smile and I felt like I was getting my CAT scans read quicker because I went down there, and it just felt like inappropriately, let's say, flirtatious. Mm-hmm. That made me feel uncomfortable. But again, it made me feel so uncomfortable, and it would make me feel that way because I wouldn't want an advantage because of that kind of interaction, you know? So. Mm-hmm. So for me personally, I mean, again, I guess if it happened, I wouldn't necessarily say it right now, but I don't feel like that's impacted me. But I do think, I'm sure it's been a huge part of it. I definitely trained with young women who were getting evaluations and reviews from superiors who had inappropriate right. relationships.
I mean, there's no doubt there is a very clear sort of difference in the way male doctors and female doctors are treated. I think that is still the case. Like, I think, you know, in some ways it's easier for guys to get things done because, you know, if you're nice and you're flirtatious and you do the, if you're charming enough, you can get things done. It's for the right reasons. You're getting things done for the patient, or the patients might treat you a little bit differently. They may be a little bit like more likely to respect you if you're a male doctor, and assume you're a nurse or a phlebotomist or something if you're not.
We definitely talked in one of the earlier episodes, I think, when Pamela, I think, asked the question about hooking up. And we talked about how I feel like I do wear my white coat as a tiny bit of a armor.
Yep.
Because I do feel like people immediately assume, being a younger woman, that I'm a nurse or a phlebotomist or a lab, you know, an x-ray tech. And, you know, I don't want to have to explain myself. I don't want it to be uncomfortable for the patient or the medical assistant.
You probably feel like you have to kind of almost announce it ahead of time so that the patient isn't like guessing and puts, you know, it's just awkward.
For everybody. That conversation, if the patient says to me, "Hi, nurse," and then I'll be like, "Well, I'm a doctor," then they're uncomfortable and I'm uncomfortable.
Everybody.
And I don't want to have to assert that. It makes me feel like I'm being sort of condescending or paternalistic, and I don't want to have to do that. I just want to be the doctor.
So we're talking about sexism, but in terms of sexual harassment, like, is it in our field?
It's in every field. And I think this Harvey Weinstein thing, there's going to be so many more examples popping up, not just Hollywood, but it happens in business. It happens in your business. Wherever there's people, it's happening. And
wherever there's men.
Hopefully this awareness will prevent some of it from happening again.
It's in the White House.
I do have a sexual harassment story I'd like to share.
Please,
and
Joe.
And this is true, I swear to God. You can find this hard to believe. About 10 years ago, and I was in real estate, and I was actually would go to the gym and actually look okay. There was a man that approached me at some sort of fair I was at trying to network. And he was like, "Hey, I'm looking to buy a $2 million house." And so I'm getting all his information, set up an appointment with him. And lo and behold, it was trying to get into my pants, which has never happened to me before. So I have
wait,
to say
wait,
that
wait.
There.
So
how did he harass you?
No, he harassed me because
I've never heard the story.
He was
before.
Trying to get me to show him houses so that I would have sex with him or hook up with him. He had no intent to buy a house.
How did you figure that out?
I looked him up on Google and found out he was in prison at one point, and he was a con artist, and he would pretend he was this rich millionaire from wherever. And wow. Yeah, he was always calling me every night, and I'd be at work and he'd be like, what are you wearing? And I'm like,
whoa.
Yeah. And finally, I had to just tell him, I'm like, hey, man, if you want to buy a house and you're serious, let's get you in qualified for a loan and we'll move forward. Otherwise, don't call me again.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's like, okay.
He asked you what you were wearing.
Oh, yeah.
What were you wearing?
He was very sexual on the phone, especially in my cubicle at work. Yeah. I had to like take it outside.
Oh, man. What a.
And I was trying to be nice, but I had to be a jerk.
But you know what? But that's a. It is an example because there was a power dynamic there that he was taking advantage of.
Yeah, he didn't care about my services in that way.
Right. But he wanted
the other services.
You had to sort of play along and play nice.
I actually felt like the chick who gets hit on and us guys can't get why they would be annoyed.
No, I totally
understand. But I felt like it.
When people make these arguments and they're like, well, this woman, obviously she went to Harvey Weinstein's room. Like that's the dumbest argument to me. Because of course you go to Harvey Weinstein's room.
Yeah.
He's like got all the power in that situation.
Right.
You have to do whatever you can to try and do something about it. Even if you know it's kind of sketchy, you have to go try and navigate that thing as carefully as possible. That's it's unfair.
It's not
to judge
the right decision in retrospect, but yeah, if you're ambitious and you want something,
you have no choice.
You make excuses. You're like, oh, I'm sure nothing will happen. You know, I met him. You know, I read this article that was written by an actress, and I can't remember who right now, where she said, you know, we met so many times. We met 4 or 5 times, and he kept saying, you should come over. So when he finally did sort of get her in a position where she was really uncomfortable and ultimately was harassed or sort of, you know, everything was inappropriate, she'd already known him. So it was like that concept of a date rape, you know, where you're put in a position and you just are like, things will be okay. And you reassure yourself and you make excuses for someone who you like and someone who can do favors for you. You know, like I get how this could happen easily. I think the people that we need to be the most wary of are the people who are getting evaluated. So for me in my career now in the last 5 or 6 years, I'm an attending physician. You know, I want to do a good job and I want to get, you know, become partner or whatever. You know, I want to go on the right track and get raises and all the good things and ultimately take good care of patients, right? But when you're a med student, a resident, a fellow, and people are evaluating you, that is what Kaveh was saying, that power dynamic. And I definitely remember being med students rotating on different, you know, rotations. We train in all these different sort of aspects of medicine. And again, these friendships developing with like attendings who are the evaluators and the med students or residents who are the people getting evaluated. And it didn't feel right to me as an outsider.
Right.
And we would talk about it probably as a gossipy kind of thing. But, you know, we all saw it. And that's kind of the only thing. And the weirdest thing is, you know, people would date also, you know, crossing these lines.
Right.
And everyone would raise an eyebrow. And in the end, I was wondering, like, so if they get married, it's okay, but if they break up,
if an attending starts dating like a resident?
Remember,
attending's the top of the chain of the medical, and then there's like the residents and the intern and medical students, it goes down.
Yeah.
So if they start dating across like, you know, ladder steps in that chain, then
people would always, you know, like we talked about with Dr. Binkley in that game of ethics, it's not inappropriate, it's not illegal, you just have to make sure you're full disclosure.
Right.
But then everyone would just start wondering and talking, and then again some of them get married and you're like, well, now it's okay, but if they broke up, that's not okay.
So I'll say this,
that's not harassment though, that's different.
No,
situation.
I know, but it's just
more like can be right
business environment situation.
It is a thin line, and that's where it becomes difficult. That's I will say this, I've given more thought to this sort of thing since I started hanging out with you. Because
I harass you.
Because I've had, yeah, exactly. Because, but not in a sexual way. Just harassment.
Violence.
And, ow, she just hit me right now. Why did you say ow? You hit me.
Because I was helping with the audio.
Yeah, thanks. Anyways, so I will say this. I did start to notice the way, and my, you know, my wife's a doctor as well, but I don't work with her, you know, intimately, at least never worked with her. But you know, working with you, I could see some difference in the way, in very subtle ways, they were treated. And mostly it's because, like, you're my friend, so, like, I'm a little bit overprotective maybe. But I did start to notice those things a little different. And
wait, how colleagues treated me, or patients, or nurses?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
I'm talking about super subtle ways.
Yeah,
that if
only
I wasn't
someone who
like,
know very
right,
well.
Right, and I started to notice those things a little bit more. And then you know, I see these people came out against Harvey Weinstein, like talking about, like, you know, Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, and how they said things like, you know, I have a daughter now. I would hate if this sort of thing happens. It opened up my eyes to this. And then there was this backlash against that. Like, people were upset that, like, they're like, what, you had to have a daughter to realize right. that women are equal people, right. which is true. I get it. I get it. But at the same time, if someone's coming to the light one way or another, you should.
However you get there right. is the right way to get
that's
there.
Overly,
you should embrace it. It doesn't do any good to then make those people feel like assholes for trying to. I mean, they're right. Like, I should have noticed this before I had a friend that was a girl.
Yeah.
I should have. And I probably did to some degree. But it didn't bother me as much until I had that emotional investment in it, like, until I saw that. So, I mean, I think it should be sort of still okay.
I agree.
But I appreciate it. I mean, I don't feel it. I don't feel victimized. But I'm sure it's there in ways that we don't know. So. It's a good topic. I think it's important in every field, any field.
So I have something totally unrelated, but something I discovered that is like the coolest thing, and I would like to share it with you guys. Hold on a second.
This is he's gonna play an episode of House of Pod.
I am gonna play something I discovered on the House of Pod. So I was listening to an episode of the House of Pod. Because why not? It's an excellent show. And so I listened to it on the iTunes like podcast app. And I think this is probably on whatever app, you know, people will listen to it on. But they have a couple of options. I don't know if you guys knew this, but you can affect the speed at which it's played. Because I have a friend who listens to podcasts and he just listens to learn things. So he puts on like double speed.
Oh, yeah. God.
So here's the first thing. So I played this at double speed and I realized I sound fast. Lizzie sounds super fast.
I sound normal speed.
Joe sounds normal speed. So can I play you a version of this?
Go for it.
Here is like...
put it right up to that
this
mic.
This is two speed.
Sharing people's stuff in their guts to... It's along the same lines. Yeah, it's about changing the microbiome.
Or sigmoidoscopy or a worst case scenario an enema where you just flush it up there. And the other option is to do it through an engine tube or use a camera from above.
Lizzie's drunk episode.
I love that what you chose for us to talk about in slow motion was like poop.
Can we hear Joe talk?
Yeah.
Okay. Both of those are you conscious?
Really yeah.
The patient.
Okay. I'm sorry.
At least you got a little Joe in there. My sister did tell me that. I think she was also trying to be like super high yield about it.
Oh dear. That was hard.
Well, that's wonderful. When we come back,
we have a really special guest. We have an actor, comedian, filmmaker, director, all around amazing dude, Maz Jobrani. We'll be right back. We've talked with internationally recognized surgeons. We've interviewed brilliant doctors who have revolutionized HIV treatment. And I've probably never been as excited as I am now to introduce our next guest. He's an actor and comedian. You've probably seen him on the CBS show Superior Donuts or as a guest on one of many late night shows like Stephen Colbert, Jay Leno, Craig Ferguson, or in films like The Interpreter or Jimmy Vestwood, Maz Jobrani.
Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, I'm excited to have me, too.
Well, welcome. Thank you.
You grew up in Northern California, right? You're the son of Iranian, you know, immigrant parents. How did you escape being a doctor?
Well, as you know, Kaveh, Iranian parents, and also I think a lot of immigrant parents want their kids to be lawyer, doctor, engineer, or lawyer. So lawyer was one of those three. And so in fifth grade, when I tried to dissect a frog, I was ready to throw up. So I knew I wasn't going to be a doctor. And basically, I negotiated with my parents to possibly be a lawyer. So I went to UC Berkeley. I studied political science, thinking I was going to be a lawyer. Then my junior year in college, I studied abroad in Italy. And while I was there, I fell in love with what this one professor was doing. And I thought, you know what? That's what I'll do. I'll be a professor. So then I came back to America and I got into a PhD program at UCLA. And I was going to get my PhD and become a professor. Again, that's a doctor of sorts.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But my parents were freaking out and they wanted like the real deal, a doctor, a lawyer. And right. Basically what happened was while I was doing the PhD program at UCLA, I got back into doing plays, which I'd started doing when I was 12 years old in school. And I realized that was my passion. So I dropped out and I really disappointed my parents.
Yeah.
Atta
that's
boy.
Our boy. Yeah,
exactly. Atta boy. So the thing we want to talk to you about first is your sister's film.
Yeah.
Everything Must Change.
It's amazing. Yes. I really, when I sort of looked it up on, you know, I think you posted on Facebook, I was like, oh, it's going to be a home film kind of thing. It's just so, and you produced it, right? It's really just well done.
Yeah, it's a great movie, man. It's exactly what you kind of expect it to be, that gambit of emotions, little bit of laughing, a little, you know, tearing up and that sort of thing. It runs the whole gambit. It's beautiful. It's, it is really a touching movie.
Will you just set it up for, I guess, our listeners who haven't seen it, just sort of the premise, because it's
absolutely
just so moving.
Yeah. So the movie, as you were saying, I actually, my sister and her ex-boyfriend, Kenny Krause, my sister, Miriam Giobrani, they produce it together. I am on there as an exec producer because I helped them get some money to finish the project and then help them on the backside. But the day-to-day producing was Miriam and Kenny. So in the year 2010, my sister was diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was a documentary filmmaker, also a reality television producer. But she immediately thought, hey, let's follow my journey. And her ex-boyfriend, Kenny Krause, who is a DP and had made documentaries with her, he followed her.
Director of photography. That's DP?
Director of photography.
Don't
DP,
use your jargon. Nice. We won't use medical jargon.
Yeah, don't use your film jargon on us.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. So long story short, he follows her through her journey, through the breast cancer, through what becomes metastasizes, the breast cancer metastasizes, goes to the liver. And sometime earlier this year, they finished the film. And then my sister, unfortunately, is not a cliffhanger of any sort. She passed away in August of this year. But as you guys saw, the movie is about, I feel the movie, first of all, the movie runs the emotions. I think my sister was very funny.
So funny.
I also think that it's obviously a poignant film because it's someone dealing with cancer, but it also is someone who realizes the value of life. I know people that saw the film told me, I felt like this film inspired me to go after what I've been wanting to do, not delay. And I've also heard that the story is, as you see the movie, somebody else saw it and they said, hey, it's not a cancer story. It's a love story because Kenny is the one filming Miriam and they are, even though they were exes, they really fell deeper in love through this process.
Yeah.
And one final thing is that it's also an immigrant story because my sister was able to take a lot of footage from our past and bring it in. Yeah. And I'm just very proud of her. And I've been telling people that if you're looking for a documentary that really goes deep, I've never seen a first person documentary of someone dealing with cancer.
Yeah.
So I'm very proud of the project and I'm very proud of my sister for doing it. And we've set up a thing where I'm in the process of finalizing a fund where 50% of the proceeds from the movie will go towards the Miriam Giobrani Foundation.
Nice.
Where we will take that money and we will disperse it among female documentary filmmakers, as well as a cancer charity that I'm going to team up with. And so it's trying to make something good out of something that was very, in the end, a sad thing for us, but trying to make a positive out of it.
Yeah,
you should be very proud. It's great. And one thing that she emphasizes it during the movie is alternative treatments. And that's something that, you know, I want to know sort of your opinion being so close to her, you know, what you think about alternative treatment, seeing her having gone through it, you know, is it a great option for people? Would you recommend it having seen her do it? Or is like hope kind of the purpose of that? And then
I think there's a good balance between Western medicine and alternative medicine. I would say, standard Western medicine versus alternative medicine, in that I feel what happened with my sister when she started going towards the alternative methods was when the cancer had metastasized and her oncologist had told her, you basically have limited time to live.
Right.
And so in my sister's mind, she thought, well, Western medicine has now said they're giving up on me. So let me see what else I can do. And so she sets out on a journey to Brazil, to India, ultimately finding a spiritual guide in Northern California. And speaking to our oncologist afterwards, the oncologist indicated to me that when the cancer metastasized, it was no longer curable. It was basically a matter of time. And the oncologist actually told me that she thought that my sister basically had about 6 months at that point, and that was 2013. But my sister ended up living till 2017, so she ended up with 4 years of life. And I do believe that some of the pursuit of the alternative medicine, what she did with her diet, she changed her diet. Yeah. I think some of the stuff contributed to her being able to then last 4 years instead of 6 months.
Yeah.
And so, but I also don't feel, I think I've heard of Steve Jobs originally when he was diagnosed going alternative, and then later on thinking, oh, I should have tried whatever it was. I don't know if he did chemo or not, but whatever it was, it was Western medicine. I really just advise people, you know, there's a fine line, because also what we have is, you guys are doctors, you know this, doctors have their own personalities. And so you might be the most genius doctor in the world, but your bedside manner might not be quite up to par. In the movie, there's a scene where my sister's going in to get a double mastectomy.
Can I guess which scene this is? This is the scene where she's having this great interaction with like the first doctor, and then the anesthesiologist comes into the room and the mood just drops, because he doesn't.
Absolutely.
And he's like, well, this is, you're lucky if you're lucky it'll be six hours. I mean, who knows? It's not great. Here you go. Here's your IV.
Yeah. So a friend of mine who is a neurosurgeon was at the screening when we did a screening in Los Angeles for it. And he came out, he said, you know, seeing that scene made me, I'm going to go tell my fellow doctors that they really should put themselves in the patient's shoes from time to time. Yeah, I think a meshing of the two worlds is really a good thing to have.
Yeah.
And you brought up a really good point, which is something that doctors should see this movie, not just people who might be patients or family members of patients, but it is important for doctors to see this movie, because, you know, it's so easy for us to forget from our, like, we are so rushed between cases, we have a lot to do, and then we have our own lives to get to. It's really easy to forget. Even for the most humanistic, nicest person, it's easy to forget the weight of this on the patients and their families. And this was good to help remind us of that. I think that was important. And the other thing that I really was struck by in the movie was the fine balance between the hope that these alternative therapies gave her, but some of the drawbacks that came with that as well. Like, there was a particular scene in the movie. She's at this healer's place in the, like, John of God's compound, and she's sitting with someone on the couch, and the person's saying to her, look, I just don't think you believe in this enough. You haven't committed yourself to this enough. And that is that's sort of like an unfair thing, I think, that patients sometimes go through.
Like, you're not getting better because you're not committed.
You're not committed.
Like, that's not fair.
You're not positive enough. And a lot of this has to do not just from alternative therapy. This also comes from Western medicine, too, because now hospitals are directly advertising to consumers. And they want to be like, our place is about hope. You know, our place is about you being the best you. You're going to be happy. We have all these things that make you happy. You have to be positive. And if you're not positive, it's your fault. And that is sort of like a heavy thing that weighs on her during this movie, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. I mean, I think when I see John of God, or I see the thing in India, you know, as someone who is not going through cancer, I sit there and I go, oh, my God, this is a lot of guru stuff. And what is this? And I personally am going, I don't know if I believe in it. But stepping back, and later on, my sister did the journey. She went to India. She went to John of God, and eventually found someone in Northern California, and I go to myself, you know what? If this person was able to give her peace of mind and was able to just make her feel a little more, because it's, let's face it, somebody gets a diagnosis of cancer or any kind of illness, it, we already have enough anxiety as it is in our lives, but this takes it to another level.
Yeah.
And so we need, unfortunately, in this world of what you were talking about, when you're a doctor, you're running around, you forget to be human. Well, we're with our phones, we're tweeting, we're on our Instagram, we're driving the kids around, we're this, we're that, we're rushed in traffic. Nobody has time to meditate and really find some peace. And so when you're in that position where you're faced with your mortality, I think that it's good to have someone that gives you some sort of hope. But that said, you're right. You can't put it on the patient to go, yeah, well, you're going to die because you didn't believe enough. Because ultimately, right, that's why I'm saying Western medicine really, you got to start with we really have some of the best medicine in the world. So you got to start with this. You got to start with whatever is required, whether it's the tamoxifen or the chemo or whatever it is. You got to start with that, and then go for the spiritual stuff and realize that sometimes you could be as spiritual as you want. I mean, you know, as my sister this past year, when her cancer came back strong, I was doing all kinds of prayers and all kinds of, I had people trying everything they could. And in the end, you realize, well, that's not, you know, as positive as I was, it didn't save her.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's just, you know, there's what is the explanation? I don't know.
Yeah. The best thing probably is a combination. You know, when I have patients who are like, I'm taking this herb and that, and I'm seeing a naturopath, I'll say, I'm going to make my recommendation. I'm going to tell you what I'm the expert in. And if there's things that you want to try in addition to that, let's just talk about it. But I can't say I'm an expert in that, and I'm not going to tell you not to do it, you know? So I do think that they're not mutually exclusive. I think that things can be in conjunction, like what you're saying, you know? And the only downside I can see is if you're going to do these sort of spiritual adventures, it sounds amazing. And the fact that she did it, it was wonderful for her, clearly. But like, you would hate to think that people are sacrificing time with their loved ones or, you know, any different kind of treatment, you know, by taking you away to Brazil or whatever, you know, I'd be like, well, come back home and see me, you know.
This is true, is when your patient comes to you and says, I want to try something alternative, I think there's a way to instill confidence in your opinion into your patients by saying, look, go for it. I'm with you. Email me if you got stuff that you think I should look at. I'm on board with you. Just do me a favor. I really feel that if we do a combination of your thing and my thing, we might have a thing. So basically, giving that patient the feeling that you are invested in them is very important, I think.
Yeah.
We talk about that a lot. We talk about how important that patient-doctor relationship is and how you can be the most brilliant doctor in the world, but you won't accomplish anything unless you're able to make that happen, which is not something necessarily to teach you in medical school, you know?
Listen, you could be brilliant and be built for research, which is fine.
Right.
So we know those guys. Yeah.
We know those guys.
Yeah.
And girls.
Yeah. But if you're going to be meeting with people day to day, and I know there's a pressure to meet bills and to, you know, to maybe, you know, certain medicines, the medications that are more prevalent or whatever, I do feel that, like you said, I think as much as we get caught up in our lives, there's a good, probably a good mantra in reminding yourself every day, I'm going to give everyone the time they deserve, and I'm going to give everyone the patience that they deserve so that they feel that I'm invested in them. Because I feel that if your patient feels you're invested in them, they're going to listen to you a lot more than if they feel like you're just clinically telling them a few things that, you know,
yeah,
I'm sorry, on the average, you're going to live X number of years. Like, you know, well, for example, when my sister was told when the cancer went to the liver, she was told by her oncologist that her time was limited. And my sister said, well, how much? And the oncologist, again, to her credit, she was hesitant to say it, but she goes, look, on average, it's about 2 years. And my sister was devastated. I was devastated. And I know that's a tough thing for a doctor to say. But then we went and saw another doctor. And the other doctor, the approach he took, he said, look, I'm not going to give you a number. And he said, I'll tell you why. He goes, there's people that have been in your situation who lived 6 months, and people who lived in your situation that lived 20 years.
Yeah.
And he goes, by the way, I could walk out of here and get hit by a car. Mm-hmm. He goes, I don't know how long you're going to live.
Right.
Yeah. Meanwhile, you got to do X, Y, and Z. And so that gives us hope as a patient.
Yeah.
Right. Right. On the medical topic, something that we were talking about earlier is just the mental health. You know, it's really having a resurgence. It doesn't get enough attention, enough money, enough resources. But with all the horrible gun violence we've been seeing over and over again, it's really, you know, it keeps coming up, unfortunately, without a solution. But comedians are famous for making fun of their own mental health issues, specifically depression, anxiety, clearly low self-esteem stuff. Have you seen that? Like, is that something that, I know it's not necessarily part of your routine, but, you know, you've been a comedian for several years, right? So do you feel like that's a huge issue among comics? Because my sense is it is, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that comedians do have a lot of those psychological issues. But I mean, as the world,
everyone does it now.
Yeah.
Right.
Being depressed is like the natural state of things. If you're not a little depressed right now, you're not paying attention.
Right.
Yeah, I feel that maybe comedians, it comes out more in comedians because we naturally delve into and observe our lives, and we're constantly talking about our lives. If you can be an accountant and never talk about yourself, you can go see a comedian, the first thing they're going to say is, so I just broke up with my girlfriend, right, or whatever it is. So we are constantly, it's almost like we are uneducated therapists in that we're just talking and talking and talking about it. And in all honesty, what you said is very true, which it's definitely looked down upon in the Eastern world, like Middle Easterners and people of that culture don't consider therapy ever. And even in America, I don't think it's as prominent as it should be. I read the book that was written by the mom of one of the Columbine shooters, and she said, in America, we are encouraged to get an annual physical checkup, but we don't get mental checkups.
Yeah.
And I agree 100%. At least an annual checkup, and even more so just on a weekly basis. I've started with the loss of my sister to see someone to help me with my grieving. So I've been seeing a grievance counselor, and it's the first time I've really gone to someone to speak to them about stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited because I think coming out of this, I'm going to go find a therapist. Because I am. I'm analyzing a lot of stuff. Yeah. Why do I do this? Why do I do that? And I just think it's important. Otherwise, someone gave the analogy. It's a teapot with a top on it that you're not letting out.
I agree completely with that.
Thank you for saying it, because I think the biggest problem with therapy and depression and anxiety is that people don't talk about it. Like, people don't talk about going to a therapist is still sort of, taboo to talk about. So, it's like, just being public about it, that you do it, is reaffirming. So it's nice. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Same exact concept. You don't have to go to one when you're in crisis. You go to one just like you go to a normal doctor to keep you out of crisis.
Listen, if nothing else, I was saying you're dedicating an hour a week to talking about whatever's on your mind.
Yeah. There's one more thing about the movie to touch on. Your brother, Kashi, he dies in the movie. You guys don't really go into the details of that, but you've later talked about it in terms of your brother having an addiction.
Yeah, my family story, I guess, has turned out to be pretty unique in that my sister, who really didn't do anything to bring on the cancer, it was random. And that's where you realize it's nobody's fault. She was just living her life. She'd smoked in the past. She drank in the past, but she wasn't a big partier, wasn't a big smoker, didn't live near a nuclear plant or anything like that. She ends up with breast cancer. She passes away. My brother, he ended up having addiction issues and he ends up passing away. Now his thing that was, as you guys know, as doctors, addiction is also a disease. And it's interesting because I feel that some people still poo-poo that. They go, no, it's not. Come on. You can quit it. You can get out of it. But being someone who has seen my brother go through it, I realized that it was a heavy thing and it was a deep thing. And in retrospect, looking back at it, I feel that possibly some of the things that brought it on to my brother were there was a lot of abandonment issues. We left Iran in late 78, not knowing we were leaving Iran. My father was on business in New York, and there was protests in the streets of Iran. But I think a lot of Iranians thought that the protests would end and we could go back. So my father told my mom to bring my sister and I to New York to spend our winter holidays. And we went, but we left my baby brother, Kashi, back in Iran, thinking, hey, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Well, we ended up staying in America. I always say we packed for 2 weeks, stayed for 40 years, because the protests got worse and a revolution happened. And then later in life, my father had to go back to Iran. After he moved to America, he had to go back to Iran when Kashi was in his early teenage years. Again, I think there was abandonment issues. For whatever reason, I think that led to him then turning to different types of medications. And I believe it was originally prescription stuff that started to would probably soothe his pain.
Yeah.
And he really was. He had one of the biggest hearts. He was almost like a child in an adult's body. He really had a good heart. Yeah. But he had the addiction issues, and it was a demon that kept coming back. And again, I tell people, I don't care who you are, it could afflict you. It could come to your family. It could, maybe you're going through it. And again, yeah. I encourage people to try and find help. There's no shame in it. Yeah. Go to rehab, go to the 12th step, whatever it takes. And he tried some of those things, but it never took. And unfortunately, in the end, he passed away as well at the age of 37.
Wow.
No, I'm sorry, man. It's amazing, actually, what you've been through and what your family's been through, and that you don't come across as bitter. You know, it's you dealt with some hard stuff. You sort of had to, your family had to leave its, you know, home country at first, under a very sort of stressful set of circumstances. After what happened with your sister and your brother, you seem to. And I don't know. I mean, it could all be like acting, but you seem
it's
to be
the wine
it helps. But you seem to be really well adjusted about it. I mean, how are you doing that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. One of them is that I've been seeing this grievance counselor. That helps. One of the things that she was saying, and this is true, it never gets easy. It still hurts a lot. I mean, especially. Both of them, but my sister was so close to me, as was my brother, but my sister was like my best friend in many ways. And so I can't imagine the pain ever going away. But this, I just know that, I mean, you take a little bit of comfort when you see other people going through it and you go, wow, what about those people that went to that church and the guy came in and shot it up? What about the people in Vegas that were, and they got shot? What about, I just saw there was a pitcher from, I think, the Phillies whose airplane crashed. We just never know what, how. Roy Halladay. We don't know what's going to happen to us. And so it is sad to be bitter. I mean, you know, all you got to do is drive around and see the homeless guy at every corner and you go, wow, he's going through stuff. I'm going through stuff. I don't know what the person in the car next to me is going through.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's a kind and generous perspective.
Great
that's
perspective. Not, yeah. It's a great perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, Moz, thank you so much for letting us chat with you. I know you're busy. We really appreciate it. The movie is amazing.
Yeah, I thank you guys for taking the time. It's called Everything Must Change. It's on iTunes. It's produced by Mariam Jobrani and Kenny Krause. Yeah, I encourage you to watch it. Have some tissues close by. I think you're going to have some laughs. You're going to cry a little bit and hopefully be inspired to live life to the fullest.
I cried a lot. I have a problem.
She does cry pretty easily, but I'll say I got teared up. It's hard, especially all those family scenes. It really hits you. I mean, it's
but let me tell you beautiful. Both. Let me tell you both. Neither of you have a problem. Crying is good.
Oh, no. I cry at like Hallmark dog commercials.
Yeah.
It's a disease.
Beautiful. That's a great thing. You got to let it out.
And thank you.
If you don't cry, it's fine. It's
Moz,
for coming.
Thank you so much.
Show.
You're awesome. It's great to meet one of your heroes and realize that they are actually a good person and they're not secretly a jerk. Thank you for not playing terrorists and shit like that. I appreciate it. You're an awesome role model to the Iranian community. So keep it up, man. No pressure.
Moz has a book called "I'm Not a Terrorist, But I Play One on TV." But he no longer plays terrorists. So
no
Moz,
more.
When it's time for your colonoscopy, you give me a call, buddy.
Or me.
I'm flying up, baby.
Nice.
You got it. I'll take good care
bye
of you,
guys.
Man.
Thanks
all right, bye.
Again.
Thanks.
Bye. Thanks for listening. Please keep the emails and phone calls coming. HOPquestions@gmail.com, 408-444-6623. And please make sure to like us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and review us on iTunes and tell your friends to listen.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.